This is Susan Livingston reporting the global extreme weather for the week ending 29 April 2016. Happy Arbor Day, everyone! I hope you have a chance to hug a tree. I did my tree tribute last week on Earth Day, so this week I'll offer a retrospective on Earth Day. The quarterly journal Jacobin urges us to, quote, take back Earth Day and demand a low-carbon socialist future. Environmental problems don't respect political borders. Ecological interdependence is another reminder that sustainability will come only through global solidarity, unquote. But global solidarity is not forthcoming. Indeed, even local solidarity is hard to find in a world of 7.3 billion eyes. Yet that ecological interdependence is a fact of life. In celebration of Earth Day, Press Enterprise listed the most critical environmental issues for Southern California. Love your mother by finding parallel examples in your habitat or in your personal sphere of influence, and then act as if you don't care whether your efforts will make a difference, just because that's the kind of I you are. 1. Using the new science of attribution, researchers at NASA and Columbia University found that global warming increased the severity of the 4-year drought by about 20%. In response to water shortages due to a snowpack reduced to zero and reservoirs at historic lows, Californians reduced their demand for water by 24% between June 2015 and February 2016. 2. The Porta Ranch methane leak is the largest methane leak ever, at least in terms of immediate human causation and immediate impact on human economy. I wonder why nobody is talking about the greenhouse effect or about the fire hazard in this wildfire-prone region. 3. The Los Angeles area has the worst air quality of any area of the nation due to ozone and particulate pollution. In order to achieve compliance with Clean Air Act standards, a 60% emissions reduction is required and not forthcoming. Nod, nod, wink, wink. 4. ExxonMobil has already been fined more than $500,000 for safety violations in connection with the 18 February 2015 explosion at Torrance. There will be, quote, a brief period of excess pollution emissions, unquote, aka premeditated ecocide, when the plant comes back online. But the company can afford the additional $5 million in fines. Nod, nod, wink, wink. 5. The battery recycling facility Exide Technologies was ordered to close a year after leaking lead-based contaminants for 18 days in March 2014. They paid $50 million in penalties, but 10,000 properties within a 2.7 kilometer perimeter will be tested at a cost of $176.6 million in public funds. 6. The public school in the small town of Hinckley remains closed due to chromium-6 discharged into unlined ponds at a Pacific Gas and Electric natural gas compression station between 1952 and 1964. The resulting drinking water contamination was the subject of a movie starring Julia Roberts in 2000. This is the largest known plume of this particular toxin in the world. 7. The 2016-17 state budget includes $80.5 million for a geothermal project and algae harvesting at the Salton Sea, a giant lake that is becoming a dust bowl. This is chump change compared to the $9 billion price tag that's been projected for the restoration of this body of water. 8. Of the 16% of new solar energy generation in 2015, two-thirds was residential. A new municipal-scale solar plant in northeast San Bernardino County generated 46,000 metric tons of emissions in its first year, displaced more than 100 endangered desert tortoises, and fried birds in mid-flight. 9. Plastic bags account for one quarter of the litter in the Los Angeles River, can be found in the stomachs of beached whales, and snare other aquatics as well as shorebirds. The state Senate passed a plastic bag ban, and the governor signed it into law in 2014 with the support of the grocery industry. But opponents were able to arrest implementation last summer by petitioning to include a referendum on the 2016 ballot. Some 147 local governments have enacted bans, most notably Los Angeles County, as of 2011. So how did you spend your Earth Day? I spent mine doing media outreach for Occupy the Farm in resistance to the development of the Gill Tract, the last publicly owned arable acreage in the East Bay, where my former farm rads are growing more than 2 tons of food per year to donate in local food deserts while educating themselves, each other, and a new generation of radical urban farmers in agroecological practices. Originally an agricultural and educational land trust of some 120 acres, the last 10 acres are under assault on behalf of a supermarket chain, a high-end retirement condo, and a parking lot. The day after Earth Day, work crews and chippers arrived under heavily armed police protection to clear the trees along the creek. These were University of California at Berkeley campus police, not municipal forces. It was Occupy the Farm's 4th anniversary, but the community-based Albany Farm Alliance has been active in this campaign for more than 20 years. Some would call it an exercise in futility. Regardless of the ultimate outcome, I call it an exercise in integrity and a labor of love. In Law Street, environmental issues specialist Kyle Downey says, quote, "Globally, considerable resources have been dedicated to flood prevention, but little commitment has been made to abating fossil fuels in the name of halting sea level rise. This is largely because it's extremely difficult to establish federal and international policy on climate change, so often policy changes happen on a more local level," unquote. Similar to the situation in the U.S., while the EU makes disaster relief funding available to its constituent states, it is the states themselves that bear the financial losses from extreme weather events and the financial burden of mitigation and adaptation. Here are some highlights and lowlights from Downey's report, along with some additional notes from other sources. The Maldives is one of the poorest and lowest-lying island nations in the world, but was committed to achieving 100% renewable energy, was first to sign the Kyoto Protocol, and had plans for a massive reforestation program along the beaches, until new leadership took over in 2013 that is more likely to protect the interests of the high-end tourist industry. Virtually all of Southeast Asia, plus the South American countries of Venezuela, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Brazil, are at high risk of flooding but have resource extraction economies that rely on deforestation, which shrinks both their natural protection from rising sea levels and their carbon sequestration capacity. Similarly, while the Middle Eastern countries of Libya, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Kuwait, and the Northern African countries of Algeria, Morocco, Djibouti, Lebanon, and Yemen may have more economic resources, their economies are so tied up in oil that their efforts are focused on disaster preparedness and relief, and they actively fight any efforts to regulate or shrink the fossil fuel market. In the EU, the UK and the Netherlands have seawalls, dikes, and sluice gates, but many scientists warn that this will not be enough to protect them from flash floods in the future. The central and eastern regions are experiencing increased river flooding due to increasingly frequent and severe extreme weather events. Hawaii was the first state in the US to commit to 100% renewable energy. This was an economic no-brainer considering the cost of importing 100% of their fossil fuel energy and in light of their abundance of renewable resources. Even in the best-case scenario, Miami and the rest of the Florida coast will disappear before the end of the century. Florida has sunk hundreds of millions into flood prevention, but has almost zero renewable power, and has made few steps toward achieving its renewable portfolio standard of 20% by 2020. New Orleans is a relatively poor city compared to New York, and has been warned by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that there's a limit to what its new $14.5 billion levee system can do in light of its geography and the loss of the natural flood protection of its former coastal wetlands. New York is outspending the world to adapt to rising sea levels, reports CCTV. According to the UK's University College London, New York spent $2.2 billion last year and will spend $19.5 billion more over the next few decades for tidal gates, beachfront walls, and retrofitting buildings to withstand extreme weather events. However, Klaus Jacob, special research scientist at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, echoes my sentiments when he says the city, quote, is still preoccupied with short to mid-term solutions. As sea level keeps rising, we will have to move certain populations out of certain areas, and that is an issue we have not yet addressed, unquote. There is also a stated goal to cut emissions by 80% by 2050. The state legislature of Pennsylvania is obstructing their governor's clean energy plan. Pennsylvania gets 30% of its electricity from coal, about four times as great a share as neighboring New Jersey. The Philadelphia Inquirer predicts a better response with the addition of funding for coal industry worker retraining programs to the plan. Some 175 countries, including the U.S. and China, participated in a signing ceremony of the so-called Paris Accord at UN headquarters in New York, reports Reuters, who described the accord as a big step on a long journey. Only 15 countries have ratified the deal, though, which means its terms are still not binding. The current U.S. Congress is unlikely to ratify the deal, especially in light of media preoccupation with the election 2016 circus, and the next administration is even less likely to exert any pressure in that direction. Those 175 countries did not include Nicaragua, reports Telesur TV, due to claims that the accord is a death warrant for the planet for the following reasons. It puts the world on track for a minimum 3°C temperature increase by making only promises that can be kept without disrupting business as usual, rather than adopting the necessary measures to limit the increase to 2°C. Far from offering reparations to those who have contributed the least to the problem but are suffering the greatest impact, the deal explicitly states that loss and damage resulting from climate change is not a basis for liability and compensation. Legally binding commitments are weak, and stronger commitments are not binding. Only countries, that is, taxpayers and not corporations, are held accountable. Only national identity and not cultural identity is recognized. In the same report, Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras coordinator Miriam Miranda says that market-oriented approaches such as carbon offsets are false solutions that give overdeveloped countries the means to shirk emission reduction responsibilities by buying up carbon sinks in forests and agricultural lands in the global south. Indigenous people are continuing to mobilize for climate justice, including legislation that would require informed consent of tribal authorities prior to development or extraction activities on traditional ancestral lands. Interestingly, developing countries outspent overdeveloped countries on renewable energy initiatives in 2015, reports Quartz. University College London professor of geophysical and climate hazards Bill McGuire said the accord is, quote, just a joke. Even if these countries kept all their promises and did what they are supposed to do, we have no chance of keeping global warming under 2°C, unquote. Note that nobody is mentioning 1.5°C anymore. Quote, new technology coupled with changes in markets, shifting consumer demand, and improved efficiency are all transforming the energy sector, unquote. But the U.S. Congress is still passing legislation that subsidizes, quote, the large, expensive, and inflexible facilities and energy sources of the past, unquote, laments Energy and Commerce Committee ranking member of Congress Frank Pallone Jr. of New Jersey in The Hill. So pay more, use less, and get off the grid, say I. In discussion with your conservative friends and family members, the DSmog blog recommends that we stick to three pillars. 1, the threat posed by climate change. 2, the corporate greed that has rigged the system against clean energy for decades. And 3, the move toward community-based energy generation as a solution. It sounds like stock neoliberal rhetoric to me. I'm dismayed at this continuing attribution of human characteristics such as greed to corporations, and this continuing insistence on solutions to climate change as if human habitat loss is a problem to be solved, and climate disruption its sole cause. You don't solve a hurricane or an earthquake. But with even a conservative outlet like American Progress naming environmental racism as a problem, maybe that's something we can solve. Consider the following. Communities of color have higher exposure rates to air pollution due to living in closer proximity to sources of industrial emissions. Landfills and hazardous waste sites also generate toxins and are most often located in communities of color. Lead poisoning disproportionately affects children of color due to the lead-based paint that is still prevalent in urban multi-unit subsidized housing. As we saw so clearly in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, extreme weather events disproportionately affect low-income communities, which in turn are disproportionately communities of color. Because of their greater reliance on municipal water supplies, low-income communities and communities of color are disproportionately affected by water contamination from spills. In a working paper released this month, experts at the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University found major inconsistencies in how federal agencies address climate change, reports the LA Times. The gap between the administration's stated ambitions and what is actually happening in the so-called Interior West is apparent. Consider the following. One way or another, Utah will get $53 million for its coal, whether from the federal government in compensation for leaving it in the ground after having duly obtained its right by 90-year-old laws to extract it, or from sales to China if they extract the coal in defiance of the Clean Power Plan. In compliance with federal law, Wyoming's slack bonding regulations on mining companies leave the taxpayer to pay the cleanup bill when the company goes bankrupt, as coal companies are wont to do in the context of the 21st century, even though this flies in the face of the CPP. Montana and Wyoming are allowing the expansion of the largest mining operation in the world in the Powder River Basin, with full cooperation and even collusion on the part of the Federal Bureau of Land Management. Europe's climate modeling efforts are aimed at providing the wherewithal for decision-makers and electricity infrastructure owners to climate-proof ever larger multinational European grids, reports Eurus. And as in the U.S., assessment of extreme weather impacts and mitigation outcomes are monetized. For example, no deaths or injuries were reported in September 2003 when a tree fell on a power line in Switzerland, and 56 million people in Italy and Switzerland lost power for several hours, but 1.2 billion euros ensured a diligent official response and continuing media coverage. Based on a 2C rise in global temperatures, so-called 100-year extreme weather events will occur in Europe annually by mid-century, reports the UK Independent. The European Geosciences Union predicts that the Mediterranean seaboard can expect annual extreme droughts, coastal floods, and heat waves by the end of the century, while Spain can expect 2 extreme weather events every year by 2080. But some scientists said we're in for a 4C increase, and no consensus emerged from their meeting in Vienna about what that would look like. In perfect alignment with our report last week about an eastward shift in the North Pole, the UK Mirror is predicting that this weekend's blizzard conditions are likely to last well into May. Remember when April snowstorms were considered stragglers? As previously discussed on this podcast, these increasingly frequent visits from the polar vortex are due to the weakening of the jet stream circulation that usually keeps it acting more like a proper vortex, i.e., circulating tightly around the North Pole. The International Business Times contrasts the past 5 unusually cold air events over Greenland having occurred since 2007 with the 5 prior to that being spread over 156 years of history, and links these anomalies to climate change as a cause and extreme weather in the UK as an effect. Sam Karana says the UK is likely to get a warm break in early May for a week or two, but that the monthly average will be cold. Some speculated that a meteor was responsible for an isolated tsunami reading from a buoy off the coast of New Jersey. Others said it must have been a submarine making a big localized wave, but it turned out that it was just the reaction of sensitive equipment that someone forgot to turn off while performing routine maintenance, reports the Press of Atlantic City. It's not your imagination that's giving you the impression that I've been moving away from reporting extreme weather events in favor of a focus on the global response to climate disruption and the even more general issues of habitat loss and the collapse of industrial and post-industrial civilization. In fact, I'm happy to announce that as of this week's podcast, Gods and Goddesses Willing and the Creek Don't Rise, you can follow me at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. I have no idea what this first podcast will look like since I'm preoccupied with the planning and hosting of a launch party on Tuesday night. According to FIZ, 240 million people across 45 low-income and/or conflict-affected countries are food-stressed, and 80 million of those are in a state of food crisis, 41.7 million of whom are located in countries affected by El Niño. The dual epicenter is in the Horn of Africa, especially Ethiopia, and in southern Africa in Zimbabwe, Malawi, Lesotho, Angola, Mozambique, and Namibia. Countries in Central America and the Caribbean, as well as the Pacific Islands, have also been badly affected by the drought. Severe food crises triggered by intensified armed conflicts have put millions more into extremely vulnerable situations in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Nigeria, South Sudan, Somalia, and the Central African Republic. In an Earth Day campaign speech, Philippine Vice President Jejomar Binay mentioned that the heat index reached a record high 52.3 C in some parts of the country earlier this month, reports the Philippine Star. The Ghana Meteorological Agency has confirmed that the excessively hot weather in that country is the result of lack of the cloud cover typically present at this time of year, and predicts that the heat wave will last well into next month, reports Ghana Web. It's been hot enough to melt asphalt and distort road markings, with nighttime low temperatures as high as 30 C. Heat-related health impacts include heat stroke, heat exhaustion, heat cramps, fainting, and heat rash. Other symptoms can include fever, headache, nausea, weakness, seizure, confusion, and coma. Heat stroke is the most severe form of heat-related illness and requires immediate medical attention. The elderly, infants and young children, the obese, outdoor workers, and those with chronic medical conditions are at increased risk for developing heat-related illness. The following low-impact adaptive measures are recommended. Take advantage of the cooling power of water. Soak your feet. Take cool showers or baths. Use a spray bottle to spritz throughout the day. Wear appropriate clothing and sunscreen. Eliminate extra sources of heat, such as incandescent light bulbs. Turn off computers and other appliances with motors. Eat fresh foods that do not require cooking. Don't eat large protein-rich meals that increase metabolic heat and warm the body. Maintain adequate hydration by drinking small amounts before you feel thirsty. If you're sweating profusely, you will also need to replace electrolytes by eating a small amount of food with your water or by drinking specially formulated electrolyte replacement drinks. Avoid alcoholic beverages and caffeine, as both of these substances are diuretics and promote dehydration. Visit public buildings with air conditioning during the hottest hours of the day, such as libraries, shopping malls, and movie theaters. Be alert for symptoms of heat-related illnesses and heat emergencies. Deutsche Welle reports that more than 300 million Indians are currently experiencing water distress, and that the drought situation is far more complex than lack of rainfall or high temperatures. Rapid population growth is a major factor due to greater urbanization and large-scale deforestation, including the ravaging of major bodies of water for legal or illegal construction. Other important causative factors are depletion of groundwater, poor water management, and chronic lack of investment in storage systems. Michael Kugelman, South Asia expert at the Washington-based Woodrow Wilson Center, also noticed wasteful practices such as round-the-clock running of water sprinklers, delivery trucks leaking water on the streets from their tanks while intended roadside recipients remain thirsty, and a subsidy structure that rewards heavy-handed irrigation practices and the growing of water-intensive crops. The death toll from the heat has already surpassed 150, and, quote, drought is a major factor in the thousands of farmer suicides afflicting India over the last few decades, says Kogelman. And SkyMet Weather predicts, quote, no chances of pre-monsoon showers over the affected region for at least the next 7 to 10 days, unquote. Pretty much the rest of April and into the first week of May. There's only an ongoing litany of shattered temperature records. Here's a sample. Odisha recorded 48°C, the highest temperature in the country so far this season, and the highest day temperature observed in the country in the last 20 years. The death toll in the state stands at 79, with 18 towns recording temperatures in excess of 40°C. More than 1,000 tankers have been pressed into water supply service, and 745 teams were engaged in repair of tube wells. Maharashtra broke its all-time high temperature record by 0.2°C, with a reading of 44.9°C. The earlier record dated back to 27 April 1973. Telangana broke its all-time high temperature record set on 29 April 1973 and tied on 21 April 2000 by 0.5°C, with a reading of 46.1°C. Nizamabad broke a 10-year high temperature record with a reading of 45.1°C, and further temperature increases are forecast to break the all-time record of 46.8°C from 29 April 1988. The Hindu reports that the temperature in Chennai has not touched 43°C during April in the last 10 years, but the highs were 43.1 and 43.7 last weekend. The record high temperature of 44.4°C was set on 29 April 2000. But in contrast to the rest of the country, northeast India has been receiving relentless pre-monsoon rains for more than a week now, with up to 1.4 meters in just 24 hours. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has resolved, quote, to provide housing to every citizen of the country by 2022, unquote. In the extreme northern city of Chandigarh, arguably one of the wealthiest, cleanest, and most literate cities of India, the Ministry of Housing and Urban Poverty Alleviation has approved the construction of around 25,000 flats for the rehabilitation of some 23,000 slum-dwelling families and the razing of the 60 federally owned acres of shantytowns in which they currently live by March of 2017. 15 of the 18 slums are slated for removal by the end of this month, reports the Hindustan Times. Across the dry corridor of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, harsh drought conditions exacerbate already fragile food security and worsen conditions for millions of people living in poverty. Honduras has declared a state of emergency, reports Telesur TV. The province of Chaco in northeastern Argentina has the highest poverty level in that country, with more than 57% of the population of 1 million living in poverty and 17% in extreme poverty, reports Interpress News. It is also the region with the second largest proportion of indigenous people. Local farmer Juan Ramon Espinoza explains that, quote, when it doesn't rain, there is no rain at all, and when it does rain, it rains too much, unquote. He and other residents attribute the increasing severity and duration of droughts to climate change driven by deforestation. Quote, they started to invade us with soy plantations, unquote, Espinoza said. He continued, quote, they used their bulldozers to knock everything down on 4,000 or 5,000 hectares. They don't leave a single tree standing, unquote. Traditionally, the main source of water for human and agricultural consumption has been family wells. But with wells going dry, a simple rainwater harvesting technology is being introduced. The first project was carried out in this area from 2013 to 2015, when 5 community water tanks were built, serving 38 families. A second project began in March of this year to build another 8 community tanks and 30 single household tanks. One person was killed and 2 more were seriously injured in Vietnam last week as heavy rains, hail, and whirlwinds impacted about 2,820 houses and destroyed 9. Nearly 100 hectares of maize and rice, along with dozens of hectares of industrial crops, were ruined. Total asset damage is valued at $269,100. Damage reports are still coming in from remote provinces. The Cornell University Chronicle reports that Vietnam's 3,000 kilometers of coastline and its prime location off the Ring of Fire is on the forefront of climate disruption and sea level rise. Development sociologist Chuck Geisler predicts that millions of people will be forced to move inland, especially from the Mekong Delta region. Quote, rising waters, storm accentuation, and onshore salinity problems will drive this migration, unquote, he said. Migration? Is it possible that a sociologist doesn't understand the difference between a migration and an evacuation? He continues, quote, but the Vietnamese have survived extreme adversity in the past and may be a leader in coping with sea encroachments and other climate changes in the future, unquote. How compassionate of him, not? In addition to extreme weather in the context of climate disruption, the visiting scientists learned that Vietnam still suffers environmental effects from the war of half a century ago due to Agent Orange and leftover landmines. It's interesting to contrast the welcoming, forgiving attitude of a 91-year-old survivor of the My Lai massacre toward these ex-Marine invaders with that of many Americans' attitudes toward Muslims in the aftermath of the fall of the World Trade Center on 9 September 2001. In Myanmar, strong winds, hail, and heavy rains attributed to El Nino have injured an undisclosed number of people and damaged more than 12,700 houses, reports the Asia-Pacific Daily. The Irrawaddy reports 14 deaths and compensation promises to households of $84 for loss of life and $42 for damage to homes. But with debris still stalling transportation, the people are pretty much on their own. 11 adds that, quote, almost 70% of the population works in agriculture, and the extreme weather, along with poverty, land confiscation, and arrests, have pushed them even further away from making a good living, unquote. Cement is the key ingredient of concrete and has an enormous carbon footprint due to the high temperatures needed to adequately heat limestone, its main ingredient, and the subsequent chemical process of creating the cement, which emits upward of 80% of the weight of the product in carbon dioxide, or about 5% of the total human-generated carbon dioxide emissions annually, according to Climate Central. From 2011 through 2013, China used more than 6.5 billion metric tons of cement, more than the U.S. used in the entire 20th century. According to The Guardian, the demand in China for sand, another key ingredient of concrete, has increased 438% over the past two decades, some 200 million cubic meters of which is dredged from the Poyang Lake and the channel that connects it to the Yangtze River. Dredging and sand removal have deepened and widened that channel significantly to the demise of Siberian cranes, Oriental white storks, and other endangered water birds, 98% of which overwinter there. The Chernobyl nuclear plant is getting a new safe confinement structure of stainless steel for the 30th anniversary of its demise, reports the International Business Times. The 30,000-ton structure is expected to be completed sometime next year and will have a life expectancy of one century. The meltdown was due to a reactor design flaw and released 10 times as much radioactive isotope as the March 2011 Fukushima disaster. In a Facebook chat, my colleague Yumi Kikuchi, founder of Fukushima Kids Hawaii, reports from Japan, where she is on a training tour with Rita Marie Johnson of the Rasur Foundation, that there has been no unusual radioactive leakage following the recent earthquakes and volcanic activity. Yet. She shares my skepticism about media reporting and says that her sources are people who have no vested interest in a cover-up. She reports that aftershocks are continuing to this day, but I could find no media reports of their magnitude or of any ongoing relief efforts. I'm standing by for more information. The Denver Post reports the return of the mountain snowpack to 100%, but says the recent storms were not enough to relieve the drought in the prairie. A Colorado University study that was published in a peer-reviewed National Academy of Sciences journal found that increased levels of nitrogen oxides and ammonia are diminishing species diversity across North America. Switzerland expects to lose its glaciers before the end of this century, which will decrease the reliable availability of fresh water, reports Swiss Info. Mountain railways will be at increased risk from rock slides and melting permafrost. More tourists will be drawn to lakes and mountains to cool off in summer, but it won't compensate for loss of rail and hotel income in winter. According to global reinsurer Swiss Re, climate change could cost the world economy around 20% of global GDP by the end of this century. But in spite of the increasing risk and the increasing expense, ski resorts and the second home market at higher elevations are likely to benefit. Say what? I'm really happy to have Katrina Rourke's explanation published in R Street to help me understand the position of the climate change deniers. She accuses the attorneys general of 20 states who have launched the investigation into ExxonMobil and others, quote, they suggest have misled the public on the dangerous reality of climate change, unquote, of alarmism. Here are her main points. She acknowledges the truth of reports of polar ice loss, but says the National Wildlife Federation's concern for the polar bears is without grounds. She also has a go at Leonardo DiCaprio's recent echo of the too familiar, sooner than expected rhetoric. Contrary to the data we've been watching from the NOAA and NASA and meteorological authorities around the world that indicates exponential global warming in the past decade, especially in the past 2 years, and most especially in the past few months, and without naming names or citing findings, she claims that, quote, researchers have been trying to determine why warming has slowed of late, pointing to several factors that might help reduce the sensitivity of the atmosphere to greenhouse gas forced warming, unquote. I wonder what factors those could be. She admits that, quote, the Greenland and West Antarctic glaciers hold enough water to raise sea levels alarmingly, close quote, but follows with the unsubstantiated claim that, quote, geological features are working against runaway melting, restricting glacial flow, slowing the pace of glacial retreat, and delaying sea level rise. Close quote. I wonder what geological features those could be. She denies the increase in intensity and decline in predictability of tropical storms based only on the fact that despite the prediction 10 years ago from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology that, quote, we're in for a rough ride, unquote, fewer storms have made landfall in the U.S. Clearly, she did not get the announcement that we can, in fact, say with good authority, as did the Natural Resources Defense Council, that, quote, climate change played a direct and possibly determinative role in the death and destruction of a huge swath of the southern Philippines, close quote, in 2013's Typhoon Haiyan. And clearly she's not considering storms that don't impact humans directly, such as the record-breaking storms in both of our largest oceans this past winter. In criticizing James Hansen for his opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline, she says, quote, it's far beyond scientific consensus to suggest that forestalling climate catastrophe requires closing off any one source of carbon, close quote, especially one that hasn't been built yet, right? She concludes that the attorneys general are not really trying to expose scientific misrepresentation, but rather, quote, discrediting any analysis that derails support for aggressive cuts to greenhouse gas emissions, close quote, and concludes that the attorneys general's, quote, crusade is a dogmatic and political attack on First Amendment rights, not a scientific one, close quote. A more lengthy paper in Heritage by multiple authors makes similar points and at least provides names, but the conclusions are based on methodological and statistical fine points that leave me scratching my head. In contrast, Dana Schmidt's report in R-Pubs is generous in providing the raw data as well as the algorithm that was used to analyze it. This study found that, quote, excessive heat and tornadoes have the most significant impact on public health, while flood, drought, and hurricane typhoon-type events have the largest economic impact, close quote. Two young people lost their lives in Indonesia when a flash flood swept them away as they tried to cross a bridge on their way to work. The flooding was caused by a combination of heavy rain, high tide, and sea level rise. More than 4,000 families, totaling about 9,000 people, were evacuated as a meter and more of water inundated 1,500 homes. Extreme weather caused multiple vehicle accidents in Cape Town, South Africa, last Friday, reports the South African News. No serious injuries were reported. AccuWeather expects flooding in the Mississippi River Valley to continue through the rest of April and into May, with some dry patches for the Corn Belt. In a report to the Union of Concerned Scientists, Dr. Gabriel Roche McNally gives a summary of her research at Iowa State University on soil health in the Corn Belt, to be published in a peer-reviewed journal later this year. She distinguishes between enhancing, repairing, and amending soil versus retaining the value of soil as a resource, for example, by means of erosion control through cover crops and no-till practices. Indiana concurs, reports Hoosier Ag Today, and reports reduction in soil erosion of 75% in no-till fields when compared to conventional tillage practices. Farm Progress reports on a recent meeting in Japan of the agricultural G7, attended by representatives from Japan, Canada, the U.S., the U.K., Germany, Italy, and France. Central to their concern for feeding a booming population in these times of climate change and urbanization is the fact that the average age of farmers is 60 years, and young people are increasingly losing their sense of place and connection to the land. The ministers agreed to the following action plan: increase opportunities for women and youth in the agricultural sector to stimulate development, expand farmers' representation in food supply chains and boost their income by encouraging them to participate in food processing, distribution, and service sectors, fight against animal and plant diseases and biological threats, establish a cooperation framework for technical information sharing among veterinary authorities in order to tackle common global challenges in public and animal health, reduce food loss and waste, support international research cooperation for climate change. Thanks for listening to the Global Extreme Weather Report. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.